Hey, home theater nerds. Hey, for Takeover Tuesdays, typically I don't do this. I don't do an open. I just go right into the conversation. But this week's a special week. Really excited to have talked to Roseanne. And after recording with her, I was just... this is one of the proudest podcasts I've ever done. And because it's not your typical home theater podcast, I wanted to start off by saying thanks for pushing play on this. Because, again, it's not your typical home theater podcast. And because of you guys, the listeners, I've given me the confidence to do stuff like this. I just wanted to say thank you to everybody. And after recording with Roseanne, I reached out. Pay attention in the podcast because there's a pretty good thank you in here for somebody. So a chance to, you'll see as you go along. So instead of me continuing to babble, let's just push play and listen to Mike and Roseanne's story.
We are Brightside Home Theater. Studio,
you look so official.
Yeah. Official, like, nerd stuff. Oh, that's so funny. So how is welcome to the Brightside Home Theater podcast, guys. This isn't really your genre, is it?
Nope.
What let's start off quickly with that. What's your idea of a home theater? What do you guys have for, like, a TV and a, is that it?
Yeah, pretty much Walmart special. Big smart TV.
Yeah, I think I always think bigger is better when it comes to the TVs. And believe it or not, roles were sort of reversed where he had to talk me down to like a 47 inch or 46 inch.
46, I think.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, we could do a 60 on that wall. He's like, no, that'd be way too big. And of course, like surround sound, which, and then I just know enough to throw out there, but not enough to purchase it and do it. So, we have your typical smart TV. That's what
there
we
do. There you go.
We have some upgrades to make. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's always fun. That's what we're all about. I'm still making upgrades. I've been doing this since the 80s. There's always upgrades. That's what everybody's always saying. So, Roseanne, thank you very much for doing this. Really appreciate it. I can say I've been looking forward to this. And as my co-host on my show said, he's like, I'm really looking forward to hearing this. If that's okay to say. And I was like, absolutely. Yeah.
I apologize. I'm sure you can hear my cat in the background.
Oh, no, that's great.
You'll hear her. She's 18 years old and she's
really putting that.
We have sorry.
A cat in the podcast.
Don't worry about it. 18.
She's got dementia, I'm sure. She doesn't know what's going on. And
yeah.
She starts talking.
We had one named Sybil. Do you remember that?
No.
Named Sybil.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. We didn't know what to name her. And we had her for like 2 weeks. And then she just used to flip out as a kitten. She used to, and then all of a sudden she just flip out and go and run all over the place. And we're like, it's got to be Sybil. And we're like, she's multiple personalities. So we called her Sybil. And she lived to be about 18, same thing, had dementia and stuff. And you just, it's sad because you're like, you come home and they're just curled up and you're like, you alive?
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, walk into walls.
She squawks big time right now. But I think it's because she doesn't realize what's going on. But
yeah.
Anyways.
All right. So what has this... You know, you and I started talking back in March. We weren't sure when we were going to be recording this. I wanted to do this, as I told you, for the 10th anniversary. And then it as scheduling came up, we were like, all right, let's wait and do it a weekend after. So, before we get into your entire story, I've told the listeners who you are, but we don't know some of them probably don't know the whole story yet. We'll get to that stuff. But how's this past week been for you guys?
Kind of exhausting. I don't want to say good because that's kind of a weird thing to say, but you know, we're fortunate that we're able to have a lot of activities to kind of take our mind off of things and to really get the time to move along. And you know, the way I look at it all the time is to just kind of get through it and get on the other side, and then you know, you're back to normal life again. You know, there have been moments of reflection at times when, you know, you're in between events or whatever. And, you know, you definitely always, I think always have in the back of your head, you know, why my life is like this right now and how it will be like this forever. And you think of the people that we've now been grouped with, type of thing. And they're with you every day. It's not like something that, you know, you forget about, you know? So, it's a lot. There's a lot that goes into it on a daily basis, as you know, whether it's a 10-year anniversary or not the 10-year anniversary. But this one, I think, is, and I'm sort of rambling because there's really there's really no exact answer on how to answer that, to be honest with you.
Ramble on, Roseanne. This is the podcast for that. That's what I do. Like when you and I were on the phone that day, we talked, first time I called you about this, and we talked for how long? So, feel free, ramble on. That's the fun, you know.
Mike, what are your thoughts?
I was going to say, Mike, what is this? I got to imagine, just throwing it out there, 1 year was probably tough. 10 year is probably the next one, maybe something like that. I'm just throwing it. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think the 1, the 5, and the 10, that's what they say with big events like this. And,
okay.
And I think it does become, you know, it's like a milestone. So, I mean, everyone's talking about it. So it does, whether you want it to be or not, I think it always becomes kind of like a big to-do.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, every year, whether it's the 1 year, the 2 year, the 7 year, you know, the Red Sox have been amazing to us. And so I think they kind of get it, where they're like, whatever you want to do, if you want to come to a game, you don't want to come to a game, you want to come to a game and participate, great. You want to come to a game and not participate, great. Like it helps like those activities, because
takes your focus off of it. All the while. Yeah.
It's bewitching time around here. We don't have kids, but we have the animals. And like, even though with the time change, they don't eat now until 6, they are bonkers at the moment. Sorry. So anyways, like, they've been phenomenal. And I think they understand, like, at least I know for myself, not to speak for the others, but on April 15, 2013, I was at the Red Sox game before the marathon. Mm-hmm. And B, you know, a lot of us enjoy going to a ball game. And so they let us really kind of more or less do what we want with them. You know, they invite us and it's great. And so they've really, for me anyways, and I think for you too, Mike, tell me if I'm wrong, but like, really kind of kept us entertained over the last couple of days.
So, oh, really?
That's cool. Which is good. Yeah. It helps. Yeah.
I obviously, the news around here, everything is all about the anniversary. And I had to stop watching it, especially I saw the reports with you and I'm like, I'm going to sit down with her and I've seen, I don't need to watch this. I'm like, so Mike, now I want to tell everybody, when you and I talked, Roseanne, you were like, Mike might actually join us. You're a pretty quiet guy, Mike, but I'm hearing stories. I've met you quite a few times, but I've never hung out with you. And Justin's telling me you have this amazing intro music scenario for Jenga.
Oh, yeah.
He was telling, he's like, you got to bring it up. He's like, you're so good at it, like on cue or something, as people are going to take a piece. What the hell's that all about?
Yeah, well, over the years, I've just developed a playlist, and it involves like a lot of, you know, a lot of walk-up songs, like for baseball. You know,
he's a huge baseball fan.
Yeah. So try to get into people's heads, you know, and it's actually better when I'm not playing. I don't think we really play that much, but it's like when other people play, because you just want to, you know, you want them to fail.
So you were like a Jenga DJ?
But that's awesome. Honestly, and I don't think Justin has been around for when you've done this. The other thing is he is huge with having touch tunes on his phone. So like if he knows if there's a place or a bar, if we're out, he'll see that they have touch tunes, and then he'll hijack the
commandeer.
And he's even been able to do it where he knows his buddies are out somewhere that have it, but he's not out, and they'll text him and go, is this your music we hear?
Mike, your music's like, it's like your playlist. And I'm like, because it is my playlist.
So you're like, here's a home theater, right? You're Tony Starking these places. You're going in and you're commandeering their audio systems, and you're commandeering it when you're not even there.
Yeah.
How does that work? I don't even know that, because I can do it. I have a remote app that you can go in and you can find the TVs and do the thing. But how do you do that not there?
Touch tunes are the same way. Yeah, you can find. I remember a couple months ago, my buddy was up in Maine. That's where his family's from. And when we go up there, we go up every summer. And by Augusta, there's a lake up there. And his parents love this Mexican place and margaritas, and they always go, and they have touch tunes. So we said, like, oh, I'm not, you know, it was a group chat with some college buddies, and he was saying that they were up there, and sure enough, I started playing Crash Test Dummies and song, and he's a couple others, and
that's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. That's so great.
We may not have the home theater stuff in the house, but he has the technical thing on his phone.
So, exactly. That's awesome. That's awesome. But it's awesome to have you here, Mike, because every time I've met you, you've just been that guy standing off in the corner, strong, silent type, off in the corner, just quietly there. Yep. It's pretty cool. That's awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. So, Roseanne, let's get into you guys. You want to get into that day? And the beginning, like you said, you were at a Red Sox game, and then we'll get into that briefly. Mike, and you, honestly, Mike, I don't even know what you were doing that day, like beforehand. So, if you guys want to get into that.
Yeah, sure. So, I'm assuming, DJ, you probably been in to see the marathon. I know your
Dawn
sister
ran it a few years before, right? It was only a few years before this. My sister ran it, Dawn.
Yep. And, or if she wasn't running it, she was with me and we were out celebrating So.
Oh, yeah. Mikey was there that day. You were there. Dawn was supposed to be with you, but she was in her office. And I think from her office, she was looking down at the area you were in.
Exactly.
And I was talking to Dawn that day because we couldn't find Mikey right after.
Wow. Did you know that? No. I mean, maybe somebody said it, but.
Yeah, I was in Connecticut at work. I started my day in Acton, drove to Connecticut, and I'm painting cars, and everything that happened. And we all, of course, everybody tries to contact people.
Right.
And I tried to contact everybody, and I got Dawn. I got Danny. Dawn told me about you right away. She's like, I don't know. She couldn't get you. I got Danny. I got Melissa, Mike's wife, but she couldn't find Mikey. They had been separated, and his battery had died.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah. So we didn't know that. So they finally, they had just left the game too. Were they with you at all? Did you ever see Mikey that day?
No.
Okay. So whatever happened, Mikey and Melissa had gotten separated. They don't know. They, when they did find each other, it was like an hour and a half later. And yeah. we were all, it was frantic. But yeah. all the while, we're going back and forth. I'm talking to Dawn and she's getting reports on you, still not really having any information. Just knowing she couldn't get a hold of you either. And right. so why don't, what, but let's, you tell your story.
Digress.
yeah.
So, you know, just a typical marathon Monday, Patriots Day, went into the Red Sox with one of my good friends, and knew that, like, we had a friend who was running, our friend Jen, and, you know, from being in, go from like having friends running year after year, you'd always go to the same spot and either go out and cheer people on that you knew that were running, or you would meet up with friends that you hadn't seen like from the year before maybe or something. So we'd always go to the same spot. But we started out the Red Sox game and got notified that our friend Jen was going to be, you know, coming down Boylston Street soon. So we made our way over to the restaurant at the time, Forum, and because that's where we would meet up with friends. Like mm-hmm. if, you know, with Dawn working, like I knew later in the day I'd meet up with her. I've hung out with, you know, her and Justin and Justin's mom. And it was just something that we always did. And, you know, got to Forum at that point and had been notified that Jen was in Kenmore Square. And then basically went outside to where the barricade kind of separates, you know, the spectators and the runners. And I don't know, we weren't out there that long. And, you know, you heard the first explosion happen down to the left. And I mean, all the elite runners had come in hours and hours before that. So it wasn't like, you know, there would be some sort of celebratory cannons or anything. So when that first explosion happened, it was from where I was, it was a weird, you know, moment where all of a sudden everything kind of just stopped, and then the quiet, and then, you know, you kind of made a quick decision on what to do. And it was only 10 to 12 seconds in between explosions. And I was at the second one and I just decided to turn and run and saw the explosion at my feet. Basically ran into the bag because I had seen the two, I guess, firecrackers go off at my feet. And then kind of everything went blank for a second and kind of came to, and it was like, okay, this is bad. not good. Huh. This is not good. So, you know, that's kind of up until that point. It was just the unknown and knowing it wasn't good. It was almost like a kind of thought of like as a horror movie, kind of like almost as if like the city of Boston was allowing some movie to be filmed at this point. And it, yeah, I know, it's just odd. Like that's what kind of popped in my head.
That's where your rationale goes. You're like, you can't even imagine that this is what actually happened. You actually try to, yeah.
No, I mean, couldn't imagine it. Why there would be a bomb, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just so weird. And I mean, I'm a big baby DJ, so, you know, you say IV, I pass out, like it, you know. And so I knew that like I couldn't look at stuff, and I'm sure that to this day my brain has to have blocked things out because there were so many other people around me. Like Mark Fukeril was right next to me, like kind of right behind me. The Norton brothers both lost legs. They were right behind me, but I don't recall seeing any of them. And I don't know if it's because I was just looking up trying to find help, or if my brain just kind of protected me in that aspect. I'm not sure to this day. But out of the cloud of smoke came this young college student who carried me to the middle of the street, and I had some people helping me, you know, try to make sure that they stopped the bleeding until I could get escorted to the hospital. And then that's where Mike comes in.
So, Mike, you want to step in? Because I'm going to guess that in from what I understand is you're right, Roseanne, is like your brain shuts a lot of that down. Even what you took in, you don't remember it. And Mike, you would know this as a firefighter, right? You've probably dealt with people that you remember stuff and they don't.
Yeah, that. And then it's like, I don't even remember from that day. It's certain things that it's like a blur. It's like, oh, like I remember seeing that person, but I don't really remember their injury or it's just the way I think the mind protects itself. That's what I've been told. But yeah.
Yeah. That's part of shock, isn't it?
Right. Absolutely.
And he's a Army veteran too. So he has been over to, he's been overseas 3 times and, I'm sure even with that, like, you know, your body has protected you and whatever, and you just, it's not something that you would have expected to see on the city streets.
No, it was shocking to everyone, you know? Yes.
How did you, can you take us up to like your day before you got to Roseanne?
Sure. I shouldn't say it, but I'm not a marathon came to that point. I always liked working. There were goods and bads about not working or working that day. It was always, you had to get up extra early to go into work to get parking because I work in the firehouse right where Hereford is and hits Boylston. So they take away all our parking and the barrier, they block the street off right from Boylston across the street to where Capitol Grill is. They barricade it and there are police there and cameras and, you know, usually an ambulance. And, you know, we park the fire trucks outside the house facing the firehouse. So like there's a street right across from it, Dalton Street. And that day we parked the trucks facing in towards the firehouse right across the street. And that, you know, it's like a block party outside. People are there watching. There's kids, people coming in from different bars. I mean, there's 3 different bars right there, Bukowski, Dillon's, and then Capitol Grill. So plenty of people drinking, various states of, you know, drunkenness, which that's the part I enjoyed. I mean, I wasn't drinking, obviously.
No, people watching.
Seeing people and our buddies that are, you know, off duty come in and they're in various states of inebriation and everyone's happy. And it's always fun. You know, it's always a good day to work and low key. And usually we don't have too many calls because other, you know, they bring in other fire companies to, you know, take our calls because we can't really move other than responding to the marathon. But in any case, we were milling about outside and mingling with, you know, all sorts of people. And yeah, we heard the first boom. And the first thought was like, you know, you heard people even as far down as that was. And I would say we're about maybe three or four blocks down from where the second site was, maybe 3. You heard the first one and, you know, there were the people were like, oh, you know, like, some people reacted to it. Some people didn't. We heard it when, you know, we heard some, you know, sighs or yells or oohs and ahs by us. And, you know, we're just kind of thinking clearly like, oh, people are just overreacting. It's probably a generator or a manhole or something like that. And then, you know, a few seconds later than the second boom. And then we were running instantly to the across the street to the trucks and, you know, trying to get through people, get our gear on and then, you know, responding without even being told to. And it was just a little confusing trying to get through people. And then the barricade was still up. So the rule at the time is, you know, no one goes on the marathon route. But, you know, I think some of us that were vets or had been on the job long enough know that, you know, you have to adapt and overcome and something big just happened and we got to get down there. So there was a string of 3 or 4 fire trucks at that point. And then, you know, some cop cars mingled in with us and we were just inching towards the barricade. The police there didn't know to let us through or not. And then eventually people just opened it up and we shot down and, you know, there was a bull rush of people at first and then it thinned out and we were right on top of it, but we didn't even know what to expect. And that was tough for us, I think, because in every call you get, you get alerted to it. Like, hey, you're responding to, you know, food on the stove, or, you know, down, or some lady fell, or, you know, a OD or something like that. So you have like the whole ride to think about, oh, this is what I'm going to do and get this piece of equipment, get that. And, you know, this one was, you know, you just pulled up and it was like, oh, we putting a fire out? Are we?
Well,
yeah. You know, you just heard booms and it's like, I don't know what that is, you know, like, so yeah. You hit the ground and it was like you dropped all your firefighting gear and then you just, all right, let's get the first aid stuff out and get going with that. So at that point, you just tried to, I know there are people trying to triage, but I just immediately started helping. And, you know, there were a couple people there that I tried to help with. And then before I got to Roseanne, but, you know, packing people up and trying to put pressure on, you know, wounds and CPR even. But, I mean, it was only minutes, you know,
yeah.
Several minutes, but, I think, Roseanne was one of the last people to go. And, when people are getting picked up and moved off, you know, I just happened to be facing her direction and she was in sort of the middle of the road, towards the other side of the street. And there were guys, you know, some firemen I worked with, and they were like, Mike, grab her head. Like, they were picking her up at that instant. So I helped pick her up on, she was boarded this time. That's what we call when we strap people into, like, the you know, ready for transport. It's like a backboard. And she was strapped in. I grabbed, you know, the head part of it. And I thought she was going in this ambulance that was firing down the street. And the ambulance just made a quick left turn on Ring Road. And we're like, oh. So we're just standing there at this point, like, oh, so where are we going with her? And then, you know, a police prisoner transport pulls up and I'm like, okay, everything was just like adapt.
Right.
I'm like, I guess I'm going to the hospital now with Roseanne, you know, because he can't just throw her in this police truck and no one told me to, or, you know, so it was just so odd how it worked out. But it took a lot of just going with the flow and trying to improvise as best as possible, and ended up taking our first ride together.
It's our first date.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sorry. Well,
night on the town, you know, lights are going.
You know, one thing he neglected to say too was that he wasn't scheduled to work that day. He worked for somebody.
Yeah, it was a swap.
He swapped. So, you know, somebody else could be sitting here right now.
Ooh, easy.
Just kidding.
Who did Roseanne, have you asked who it was? Who'd you swap with?
Actually, I don't know. Starkey. Oh, was it Starkey? Oh, no, I wouldn't. It was too young. Starkey's too young.
Oh, God. That's funny. Or, yeah, but Mike, do you think if the ambulance hadn't taken the hard left, do you think you just would have put her in the ambulance and gone back to the streets?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There would have been EMTs on there. So,
That's what I mean. Like, you would have passed her off and then, were you who else was in the prisoner transport vehicle with your prisoner there?
Well, Mark Carrell. And then there was like another fireman that I don't really know. He was, because we had guys that, I mean, they have detail people, like the detail cops that are working, and then they have detail, lesser of them, but detail firemen and EMTs that are just kind of walking around in case they're needed during the marathon. And one of them was a fireman that was on a detail, and he ended up tending to Mark while I was tending to Roseanne.
Ooh.
And I like DJ when I've been doing the public speaking and kind of sharing the story. You know, I mean, obviously it was a very bad day for a lot of people, me, Mike, people that, you know, whether you were a first responder or one of the, you know, injured. My best way to deal with it is really by humor. And I love when I am presenting and I ask, you know, I'm telling the part of my story of how I ended up at the hospital in the back of this police transport vehicle or paddy wagon, as we call it, not so politically correct here, in Boston. But
it is Boston, so it's okay.
What we grew up with.
Exactly.
But, I like to ask the audience, I'm like, okay, who here has ever been in the back of one of those? And you get usually like the crowd will be like, oh, quiet. And then like one person might just kind of do like a little slight hand raise to like, you know, say that they've been. But it's just so funny because a lot of times with the corporate people, they're like, oh, I can't admit if I've been in the back of a paddy wagon. It makes me chuckle. Like,
yeah.
They don't expect that question. And
well, let me ask you, had you ever been before then?
No.
Because you've had your days.
We've had fun. a police cruiser is a whole nother story, but
correct.
A transport vehicle, box right. truck, never had been in one before. So, wow.
So how much of that do you remember being in that? In
all of it.
What you do? Okay, so you remember Mike. You remember all of that.
Yes. Yep. I remember asking him if this, you know, I was like, this isn't an ambulance, is it? He's like, no. Because in my mind, I was tracking more. I was hoping to get morphine because I was in pain at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, you know, as I would hear the ambulances coming and then going, I'd be like, oh, there goes my chance to get pain meds, you know?
Right.
And then I'm like, okay, so now this is not an ambulance. So I'm not going to get morphine in the back of this. And I was basically mentally trying to track my way to the hospital, knowing that that's where we were on our way to.
And so, and Mike, you guys are just, you have nothing to deal with this with, right? You're just what, trying to,
yeah.
How are you handling this?
Well, she's lucky too that Roseanne and Mark were lucky that, you know, there were firemen back there just because we have, flashlights on our coats.
Oh God!
Because I mean, if we didn't have that, it'd be pitch black. Because it was completely dark.
There's no lights back there.
So we each flipped on our lights, and then we started talking. You know, I was happy with Roseanne because I knew she wasn't in shock because she was very alert and with it, and asking me questions, asking me how much longer it's going to be. Are we going to Mass General? And I'm like, geez, lady, I don't, you know, like, yeah, I'm on Mass General. You know, are we on Starro? I'm like, yeah, we're on Starro. Like, there's no, I can't see out. I'm like, yeah, we're on Starro. And she made me hold her hand. And that was something that I didn't want to do because she had cuts on her hand and I didn't want to infect her hand. And I'm trying to hold, like, she's on a backboard. So she's sliding around. Because the police truck's flying, you know, it's taking corners, and you know, she's sliding around on this bench,
the metal bench back there, and so, there's nothing to strap
you down. Yeah,
no,
and I'm on my knees, and this other guy's legs are interlocked behind me. You know,
oh,
like
God,
feet on our knees, facing you know the walls of it, and
right,
it was it made me laugh thinking of going to church when I was a little kid and just hating kneeling. And yeah, that it was a little bit of a painful ride, but I knew my place with someone else that was in more pain, you know? But, it was hot. And I mean, just, it was a ride, you know? I mean, I don't mean to sound excited about it, but when I do think of like, it was dark. I remember being in there and it stunk and I'm like, wow. These cops don't clean out their vehicles. This is disgusting.
I don't think it was that.
And I'm like, it wasn't. It was them. It was, you know, the burns and the burnt hair, body fluids. And it was just like, oh. So, it was a ride to remember. And then someone was coherent the whole time asking me questions and, you know, which was good. I was happy you were doing that, you know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Yeah. There was, Roseanne, you made the news. You were one of the people, we saw you being moved, I believe.
Oh, really? I don't know.
I think Dawn was telling me, I can't remember who, I thought somebody was moving you, but maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I thought because we were trying, because we had found out. Do you know how maybe Don would have got the information? Do you remember how we found out the first time? Like what had happened to you? Because it was, we had found out fairly early and that you were being moved to the hospital. So somebody with your group knew.
So I do know, like, Megan was kind of sort of, our friend Megan was sort of with us, but not when everything, she was there right when she got there a few minutes before the bomb went off. And then when the bomb went off, everybody kind of got separated. But there were two friends, not Megan, but somebody else, who had seen me on the street, and I had given them my sister's telephone number to contact my sister to tell them I had been injured. So I'm assuming somewhere through that channel, you know, it had come out, but I'm not sure. And I think, like, and it's odd because with your hair being singed and all that, it's hard to recognize people. And I'm thinking maybe it was somebody else, maybe that they had seen me, because at the first location, there were a lot of cameras down there. Like a lot of the news cameras were there because it was the finish line. A lot of reporters were down closer to that. So I know they were getting a lot of footage from that more so than where I was, because a lot of the people, even down at the first location, didn't really know that a second bomb had really gone off because there was so much going on down there that, you know, there wasn't a lot of acknowledgement of the second one. Just
The chiefs, the fire, police, EMS at the first site, you know, because all the headquarters, you know, they have the little trailers and command posts, and they're all set up by Copley. So I think they got so involved with the first one that the second site was more of a, what's going on down there? Like, you know, everyone was preoccupied with the first one, and that's where most of the ambulances were staged anyway. So, I do believe they got the first round of help, you know?
Yeah. So in the ambulance, I mean, in the ambulance, in the van.
Yeah.
On the way. Talk about the transit. And this is the part where when you're speaking, and I've seen you speak a few times, and it's like I get choked up when you're going into the hospital and Mike goes with you. So, you know, that, you know, let's take everybody in there.
So, you know, I mean, at this point, up until, you know, getting to the hospital, like I've kept myself alive, I think, because I kept myself conscious. I think in my mind was that I knew it was really bad. I knew I was losing a lot of blood, and that if I kind of went into unconsciousness, that I was going to die. That was my thought in my head. It doesn't take a smart person to realize that when you lose a lot of blood, you're not going to live, you know? So I knew that it wasn't a good situation. Then I knew the people that had surrounded me, from the point of like being on the street to the back of the wagon to us getting to the hospital, they did all they could to keep me alive. And as soon as we got to the hospital at that point, I just kind of let myself go because I was like, all right, I mean, we've done everything we can for me. And now it's up to the doctors to do what they can to save me. And so, you know, I do remember, I think, I had started to hallucinate, like when the doors of the truck opened back up to get me out. You know, for some reason I thought they were taking me into the basement of the hospital to a gymnasium because we were under attack. You know, when those doors opened up and daylight hit me, I was like, all right, I'm out. Like, this is it. I can't do anything else. And so, you know, he brought me in back there, but I thought I was I thought they were taking me to the basement. For some reason, I thought that Mass General had a gymnasium. And I don't know, maybe it's from years of watching MASH and, you know, being attacked or being in a war zone or something. And
well, it was set up that way. It was the ambulance bay. So you're partially right.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But
and there was a lot of confusion with that because I remember hearing the cops in the front yelling at the attendees, you know, when you're pulling in that, you know, they're like, hey, you know, this is for ambulances and the, you know, something really big just happened. And they're like, yeah, we know we got them in the back, you know, and they were like, yeah, having them. And then I remember the doors finally opening and then, you know, nurses just being like, oh my God, they're bringing them in police group, you know, trucks and then just seeing the shock too. I remember with, you know, because nothing's set up. Like they're used to the gurneys coming out of the ambulances and we just had them on backboards. Yeah. So we actually had to get the cops in there were helping pull them out of the ambulance. And I'm in there, you know, handing her off. And, you know, we get her on the, got her on one of the hospital's gurneys and we're wheeling her in. And at that point, I'm still in full, you know, fire bunker gear. So they're seeing a, you know, a fireman with a helmet and the nurses are just like, what is going on? You know, like it was just an odd scene, cops, firemen, you know, wounded people. And, you know, and then once Roseanne got handed off, it was a big sigh of relief for us. I know.
So
a lot of that work really started.
Let's see what he's whining about. Go ahead, DJ.
Oh, so how long did you get to stay with her on that initial day?
Not long. I mean, right after that, we just got right back in and went back to, you know, the site. So we didn't know. We heard like there were more bombs going off. So
yeah,
we didn't know what to expect, and I was trying to find my guys and. They dropped us off at the first site, so I had to walk up an alley because at that point the street was closed down. And, you know, I was walking up the alley in between Newberry and Boylston Street all the way back to the firehouse. And I got back to the firehouse. And that changed into a police command post. So I had to figure out where, you know, my guys were. And they actually were at, I believe, the corner of Comm Ave and Mass Ave. So it was a little walk, but anyway.
So you're just there on your own, and you just got to get back.
Yeah.
And then, so the rest of the day, how was that rest of the day for you? Like,
just high alert, like you were just waiting. There were just so many reports of everything was a false alarm for, you know, suspicious packages. Everything was a backpack somewhere, and. You know, the police go and we back them up in case, you know, after, you know, if it is something after it blows up, it's our problem. But before it blows up, it's their problem. But thank God there wasn't any, they never, you know, nothing was real.
Yeah. So after you got handed off, Roseanne, how much of that do you remember? Because you were hallucinating, and this is where you must have gotten your morphine that you were looking for in the back of a paddy wagon?
Yep. Morphine's a wonderful drug.
Happy days.
Yep. I think I'm funny now, but I think I'm even funnier when I've had some morphine.
I think most people are, no?
I don't know. I'm not really sure about that. But, you know, they took me in. And I know this will sound awfully funny, but I was super, super lucky. As soon as they brought me in, it was timing of, the surgeon who, he's in the National Guards,
Army Reserve,
Reserves. And he's a doctor. He ran the marathon. People were like texting him saying, where are you? Blah, blah, blah. And
he had run the marathon that year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That day.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He runs it in like 3 hours. He's like ridiculous. Jesus. But he had seen, like, he walked in right at the same time of me being brought in, and he had seen my injuries, and he knew immediately that it was an IED, and he knew immediately that he had to get me into surgery right away. So you know, someone who had experience with this scenario, and he knew what he needed to do and was basic, like, let's go. And, you know, they put me into an induced coma for surgery and to make sure that my organs wouldn't shut down and to make sure that I would, you know, pull through everything. And so, you know, from the time of being dropped off to the time of being dropped off to, that was Monday afternoon till Tuesday late afternoon. I mean, I was out. So, and I woke up without my leg, basically. So, I didn't have a choice. I didn't have to sign a form, you know, and oddly enough, some people from that day who lost limbs, they had to sign waivers for their surgery, for their amputation. And right. I'm like, you know, I'm like, form, there was no form. It's like, there was no question. There was no asking. There was no approval. And as a matter of fact, I have heard stories of my mom basically going up to the surgeon when he came out to the waiting room to let families know what was going on with their loved ones. You know, my mom went over and she's like, who gave you the authority? He goes, I did. He's like, she had no choice. And my mom was like, well, who's going to tell her that she doesn't have a leg? And he was like, I'm going to tell her. And so when I came through and, you know, he came to tell me, or they, you know, came to tell me or whatever, that I lost my leg, the morphine was definitely flowing nicely. And he's like, you know, right now you're below the knee. He's like, you know, I had to remove part of your leg. And I'm like, that's fine. I'm like, that's fine. I'm like, can you just make it like the scar into a rose? Like, can you make it look pretty or something? And I guess he looked at my mom and he was like, she's going to be okay. Like, she's fine. He's like, you can tell when they're coming out of it and what their attitude is going to be with everything. And he knew that I had the right attitude to move forward. So, you know, I guess growing up with the tough love that I did and, you know, the family dynamics, that it helped me be who I am today, which is a good thing. And, you know, I always look at it this way, that not that I'm happy it happened to me, but I'm happier that it happened to me than some of my friends, because I don't know if they would be where I would be today. Like, just because we all have different personalities and outlook on life, you know, and my outlook is like, you have the choices to make things good or bad. And I think, you know, right from the beginning, my choice was to figure out how to get through this.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I mean, Mike, like you said earlier, that day started for you when, you know, the first you're trying to get trucks through and it's adapt and overcome. Right. And that's basically been Roseanne's life since then. Right. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's either that or just sit there and wallow. And, right. You know, Roseanne, you've never been like that.
Well, I have those days, yeah. You know, my wallowing is to eat chocolate or ice cream or whatever and then move on. Like, I feel like you have to have them. You have to accept it and deal with it. And tomorrow's a different day. And then you forget about it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody does. So like, all right, when did you go back? Because here's the part where this isn't where you're, everything up until now has been, you know, your typical marathon bombing, right? That's the story. Typical, you know, this is what happens. You know, person injured, firefighter helps. Now, where does this story deviate from all the others?
So it was a 24-hour shift. So I worked straight through the night. And then, and the whole time I'm like, oh, you know, you went through this harrowing experience with, you know, two people in the back of a, you know, three people, well, yeah, a whole bunch of people, but two critically injured people. And you're like, I hope they lived, you know, I want to make sure that they were still alive. And there were so many people, and with everything that happened that day, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, something good happened, you know, we, you know. So the next day another guy I work with, we went to Mass General and just to ask, you know, whomever. We knew security was going to be tight, but, you know, and it was a lot tighter than we thought. We went up to security and asked if, we described who we brought in. Because
you didn't know my name, right?
No. And
I was going to say, how did you find her?
They were just described the injuries and, you know, I was able to tell them. And I think the guy was very sympathetic. And then it helped that my buddy is a Quincy guy, too, and actually knew who he was. And he was like, yeah, I think she's going to be OK, you know. And it was like a huge sigh of relief. And then like, OK, well, you know, no big deal. But we just dropped, you know, here's some T-shirts for their family or wherever, because we figured there'd be a bunch of people in ICU. And, you know, they passed them on. And then that happened. And I think since I knew where she was a few days later, I visited the ICU. You know, I asked security if it was OK to, you know, see, make sure it was okay to, if they wanted to see me and the family. And I was able to see them, and, you know, because I wasn't, obviously the day after, I wasn't able to see Roseanne, and I wasn't really trying to. I really just wanted to make sure she made it, and, you know, yeah, something good happened. But anyway, I really forget if your family got my number, or I think they did somehow. But anyway, there was a link up with me and their family, and I met them, and they got them a bunch of T-shirts from work. And I did eventually see you a few days later.
Mm-hmm. Thursday, I
think. Yeah, really quick. And then it really kind of, you know, that was the best thing I could hope for, you know, seeing that she was okay, seeing her smile. And then I got a phone call from her sister. Because everyone's like, all right, but why'd you keep going back? And I'm like, I got a phone call, a voicemail from her sister. And it was like the most touching voicemail I ever got. Her sister was crying. And she was just like, that's the first time Roseanne smiled in days. Please just keep coming back. You made her laugh. And I'm like, yes, I'm going back. And then, you know, like they were actually a very, very sweet family. And then I got to know Mark's family. And then, you know, I think at that point it was the cops thing, finding the bombers. So I guess I made it my thing to do with, like, as long as the family wanted me to keep coming back, and I was someone in the city that could help with parking or bring sandwiches, or I guess allowing me to come and do like little errands for them felt like I was doing something for, you know, because you just felt helpless. The city got attacked, and like, what do you do? You know, so. It was just my little way of helping out, and if I could in any way. That's how it started. Long story.
Yeah. That's funny, because it's like, that's you, though. That's a firefighter. It's like, you helped that day. Your job's done, buddy.
And it's so funny not, you know, being able to help more. Like, you know, there's bombers out there. And it was just frustrating afterwards, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, So, Roseanne, can you talk a little bit about your injury? What happened? What ended up? Because you did end up, I remember going through that, where you lost, they eventually had to go over the knee, which was a big deal. That was the first time I learned about that, like the difference between below the knee, above the knee, and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I knew of a person who was an amputee, a guy that I went to college with who had, during college, he was not an amputee. Then several years after college, he got into a bad drinking and driving car accident, and he became an amputee below the knee, which I hadn't seen Paul in, like, I don't know, many years. Lived in Colorado at this point, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, technically, I didn't really know of an amputee in my life or know anything different about it. You know, yes, that was the worst of the injuries, is that they started out below the knee. And, you know, what I did learn from Dr. King is that with amputating, it's not so much like the damage that's done to the limb as much as it is also into cleaning out the wound. because what does kill people is more so the material or the objects that get into the bloodstream, that get into the heart and then can clog the veins and all that. So, you know, he was like, it'll dictate how far up I go, depending on how badly stuff got into your wounds and how he could clean it out. So, you know, it was kind of a combination of the damage and then the foreign objects that would enter my system. Aside from that, you know, I do think that I was very fortunate because I don't think I had as many serious injuries as a lot of the other survivors have had. A lot of them had to have skin grafts because they were super burned. You know, I learned of people that had their car keys or their like had change in their pocket, and the heat was so hot from the bomb kind of burned, you know, quarters into their leg and, you know, like just really bad stuff. And even like Mark Fukeril, who is right basically behind me, he's amputated above the knee as well, but his other leg, you know, his sound limb is probably even worse than his amputated leg because they were able to save it, but it's still got a lot of issues with it. So he has to wear a brace because they don't think that if they amputate it, that the skin grafts that they had to do on it will withstand the abrasion that you get, like when you use a prosthesis. So, you know, he's got these other injuries. So long story short, I'm lucky. I'm an amputee above the knee. I had burns to my right hand, but none of it needed skin grafts. Didn't even honestly realize, but I do remember thinking back to being in the back of the police transport vehicle and asking Mike to hold my hand and thinking back, and it was all oozy and gross. And here I am like, just, can you please hold my hand? And he's like, oh, like,
sure.
Yeah.
He's, you know, still saying that. All right.
Firefighter 101, don't touch somebody else's bodily fluid or open wounds, you know, and here I am asking him to hold my hand. And I had exploratory surgery to my abdomen because in the explosion, part of the barricade, I think, hit me in the abdomen and I was having all kinds of bruising. And they wanted to make sure I wasn't having internal bleeding. And so it's funny because I've asked Dr. King, I'm like, you know, my belly button's a little awkward, like off because of the way they had to do the stitching. And I said, why don't you just sew it up or whatever? And he goes, I learned the hard way years ago. He said, I had to do some sort of similar surgery and just decided, you know, as an adult, you don't need your belly button anymore. So he just sewed up this gentleman's belly button. And the guy was like really upset that he did that. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if I would be upset about it or not, but either way. But I feel like it was a shorter moment. Obviously, like I have to live my life now as an amputee, but I had my kidneys shut down on me from the trauma, which, you know, is pretty, I guess, sort of typical when you're in such a traumatic situation that your organs are like, okay, well, she's not doing this, so she doesn't need me. So then this shuts down, then that shuts down. So my kidneys weren't working and I ended up having to go in for dialysis. Thankfully, knock on wood, it was like basically one and done. But the day that I got brought in for dialysis was the day that I had been transported over to Spalding to the rehabilitation hospital, but it was in their old facility. And I was there for 4 days, and it was the day that they were opening up the new facility, that fourth day, that everybody was being transported over to the new facility. Basically, they transport me over, you know, they asked me to do an interview. I do it from like this new hospital bed. And then all of a sudden, like the cameras leave and they're like, okay, now you're going back to Mass General. You're going to have to go for dialysis. And I was like, I lost it. Like, I was like, what? I don't understand. Like, you took my IV out of me when I was at the old Spalding, which to me was kind of like things were on the up and up. Things were better. Yeah. I was feeling like no more IV port. This is great. And then all of a sudden, then they start telling me that they're going to have to put a catheter in. And I'm thinking like a catheter that like you go to the bathroom in. They're like, no, it goes into, you know, your main artery so that we can. And I'm like, so that means you're going to cut into my leg. They're like, yes. I'm like, okay, well, you're going to put me out for this. They're like, no, you're going to be awake for it. And I'm like, that's disgusting. I'm like, give me Valium. I think it took 4 hours for me to calm down for them to do the dialysis. And it was making me feel like I was having an asthma attack. It was like all this, I could feel this fluid in my chest. It was awful. Like the, again, to me, the dialysis was probably like the worst part of everything. It was awful. Ugh. You know, I think because of that, they had to keep me an extra week in Spalding, where a lot of people were getting out in 2 weeks. I didn't get out for 3 weeks. And it was just, that was, I think, the toughest part really of everything.
Yeah. It sounds like it was like you thought the light was at the end of the tunnel type of thing. Yeah. And you were like, nope. And it's like everything else. Yeah. That's, oh.
Yeah. That was tough. That was definitely tough. But we're here today, DJ.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. So what's it been like? You know, the first year, tell everybody what it was like adapting and overcoming. It's like, I mean, it was quite the learning curve you had.
It still is every day. I mean, there's not, you know, it's.
You make it look good. You make it look easy.
Thanks. It's not.
Every time I see you, I'm like, seriously?
It's a lot of work. It's exhausting. There's mornings I wake up and I'm like, oh, I have to put my leg on. It only takes a couple minutes, but it's just a process. And, you know, I don't know. Like, I won't lie. I miss being able to jump out of bed. You know, I miss being able to throw a pair of shoes on. Everything is like time consuming. It's different. I got to, you know, sit down to put my shoes on. I usually have to use a shoehorn to put my shoes on, or have Mike struggle to jam it on my fake foot. And, you know, everything is a challenge. You know, the difference between year one and now is that I have a little bit more trust in the prosthesis. Whereas, you know, early on, you don't really know how to use it, especially being above the knee. So I have a microprocessor knee that helps, you know, bend, but you know, it's not that it does it on its own. I've got to learn how to move my body to move the microprocessor knee. And, you know, even just if I don't have the right flexion on the foot when we're walking and it's a different incline or decline, you know, but I'm better at being able to catch myself now if I lose my footing for the most part. Although I was out to dinner with our friends Tracy and Carolyn and Kathleen, and coming out of the bathroom and just walked over to the table, and for whatever reason, my knee just gave out and down I go. And of course, like, then management comes over and everybody's like, are you okay? And of course they think I've been drinking, which I hadn't had an ounce of alcohol. And, you know, and then I was like, maybe I should be drinking. I don't know. Maybe I walk better when I've had a cocktail or something. I don't know. But it's just, you just don't know. It's a day to day, minute by minute. I mean, he knows. Yeah.
It's a battle.
But if you want to do anything or enjoy life or just go about as, you know, as close as you did before, then you got to get up, you got to put your leg on, you got to get up and do the work. And, you know, it's just it's different, but it's, I don't know, I guess you got to do it.
Yep. And you are. And like I said, you're doing. Like, you make it look easy. It's you wouldn't know it talking to you, you know, normally, So you, and I think that's part of your pride too. You don't want people to know.
No, God, so, no, yeah. No. I always think I have it. Like if I have pants on, I always think that like no one would know, no one would be the wiser. Yeah. And then like somebody will say something. I'm like, oh, they knew. Like,
yeah, you're competitive like that.
Yeah. Like, how did they know? Oh. But I don't think it's that, like, I mean, I'm sure it's not that incognito, but close enough.
Yeah. Well, even at that, I was looking through pictures the last couple of weeks of the event that my sister hosted at Fenway. Mm-hmm. Even at that, which was what, a month, 2 months later? Well, that was fairly
early. In September. So.
Okay. So a few months later, there were pictures in that if you looked at them, you wouldn't know you had lost a leg.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it. I was like, I showed Jen. I was like, look at this. I'm like, it's like she, you're just, and yes, they're photographs. So it's not like you're, we didn't see you moving, obviously, but standing there, you were like, wow, it looks normal. Looks great. So,
well, it's funny because there was one time I was getting the back of an Uber or a taxi or something, and I had shorts on. I was meeting up with you somewhere, and I got in the back of the taxi, and I was going overnight. So I was bringing crutches, so, you know, to use to go to the bathroom at nighttime when I take my leg off. And the driver was like, oh, did you hurt your knee? And I was like, you could say that. Like, yeah. You know, it's, yeah, yeah, you yeah. know, but I don't think he saw it. Like, I honestly don't think he saw it. I'm like, I just think everybody sees it. I just think it is like a blaring.
No.
Sign.
No, I don't think so. Do you, Mike? You would probably know more. It's like you'd see people's. I think you have a different perspective than she does watching people, right?
It depends what she's wearing. Like, no. You know, if you're wearing like a skirt,
yeah,
shorts, yeah, it's hard to hide. But I mean, like, that's. I don't do anything mean. But I do, there is part of me that enjoys, he gets the double looks. I do like looking right back at the party because they look up and then they catch me staring like right at them. You know, and it's only for a second, but it's just like, all right, take it easy. I mean, it's always like, it always is. It's funny. It's like, it's always like really old people and little kids that just can't stop staring. But sometimes there's a random person that, you know, like, all right, you know, like, I understand everyone wants to, if they see it, they'll look, because it is unusual, you know, like, I understand. Yeah. But some people hold it a little too long, and then that's when I feel the need to like give a little glare back and make them uncomfortable. They do get uncomfortable. They know what they did. Most of them look away, you know. But
And this is the audio only podcast, so I'll just let the listeners know, if Mike is looking at you like that, you're not having a good day. He's not a small man.
Oh, if they don't know me, but if they do, they know.
Yeah.
Big Mark's small.
That's funny. That's funny. So how long, Mike, why don't you start out then with like, how long did you guys, let's keep it all positive from here on out, huh?
Perfect.
Because that's what you guys have done. I mean, this is Brightside Home Theater, and you've brightsided the bejesus out of this story. what was your courtship, if you will? What was that like? And like, how early did you know you guys were going to end up together?
Yikes.
Mike's still not sure. Typical guy. I'm still counting the days.
You know, I do remember early on thinking she is cute. But I mean, actually, we'll go back to the hospital. First time I met you. Mm-hmm. She had this smirk on her face. I think she was drugged up. Looks at me, and she's kind of like with one eye. She's kind of, one eye's half shut. One eye's, you know, it's just, she had the funniest face. I think your mom was in there.
Yep.
And she's like, you're too young for me. Or I'm too old for you. And I'm like, I didn't ask. I really.
Just saying hi.
All right. It was just. you know, but anyway, like we've kind of always laughed at that type of stuff. And
because my mother was pressuring right from the beginning.
Right. And oh, well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But, you didn't know, but between her and my friends.
Yeah.
Don said it. Don was like right away. You know that. Don was right away. She's like, they're going to end up together. He's awesome. He's awesome. I don't know if she knew that your family was contacting him, though, because when she was telling me, it was like he keeps coming around. But yeah, but then you hear Mike's side of it. It was like, well, what was I going to do? They kept asking for me. And yeah, you know, it's like, it's not like he was creeping in. It was
like, no, and that's what I know. Petrified of. And then, you know, but right. Funny part about it is it's like, I became friends with her friends and they were like hanging out with Carla, Dawn, you know, like they're fun people, you know, like they're, it was always like, oh, you visit Roseanne and, you know, cover your ears, but then like, we'll go out and get something to eat and some drinks. And
yeah.
So it was kind of, you know, it was a good time and, meeting good people. And then I feel like that was a draw to Roseanne, just being like, wow, she has a lot of good, you know, friends, like there's more friends than people I've ever met, you know, like
they, oh yeah, yeah, which, Dawn, Roseanne, that entire I've hung out with them, and just knowing Dawn, it's like, I mean, my sister, and you're just like, it's, you guys were always just an insane group, and it's like the life you guys were living, and you went down in Newport, you did, I mean, you live and still continue to live a great life, and you surround yourself with great people, and then Mike gets thrust into that.
Thrust is the right word, DJ.
So it wasn't a hardship, you know.
I'm not sure he realizes still yet what he's gotten himself involved with, you know. But you know, I guess that's the thing that I'm fortunate and very blessed with, is that I have so many good people in my life that they're the ones that have pulled me through all of this, you know, including Mike at this point of life, you know, and it's, you know, it's something that prior to April 15, 2013, I worked hard for of having a good life and enjoying life. I think, you know, we only have one to live, and I've been fortunate to meet such great people, and they really rallied around me back then, and they still do to this day. And I think if this didn't happen in 2013, if, you know, if I was still who I was back then, I'd still have this great group of friends, you know.
Yeah.
But at that point, I wouldn't have met Mike. So, you know, you got to take the good with the bad, as you do every day of life, no matter what, and figure out how to make it work, and where you are today, and just keep going forward. And that's what I've done. And it's been with those people that were there from day one. And that includes Mike too. And, you know, I wouldn't have it. The only thing I would change is I would like to have my knee joint back. Aside from that, you know, not having that knee is the hardest part of all of it. I'm envious of people that are below knee, because it's a little bit easier. It's still a challenge, but it's a little bit easier in life. But aside from that, I really wouldn't change any of it. So, you know, we did spend a lot of time together. We did spend a lot of time together in the beginning. His schedule was different than my family's, where, you know, he could help take me to doctor's appointments and prosthetist appointments. And he was able to take the time, you know, with work, either swapping or doing a shift, and then he would be off. And my family had spent so much time at the hospital. I was in Mass General for a week, and then I was in Spalding for 3 weeks. So a month of coming into Boston every day, and making sure that I was okay, or, you know, bringing food or running errands or dealing with paying my bills and, you know, things that had to get done, even though I was not capable at that point. And so I'll never forget, though, when we started dating, I was like, listen, we're not telling my mother, because she was so adamant in those early days. And I'm like, I don't want to hear it. Like, I just can't deal with hearing about it from her at this point. So,
right.
You know, we had made an agreement in the beginning. We're like, right, we're not going to tell her what's going on. You know, God forbid. So, but you know, we have a good life together, and we still do fun stuff, and you know, we get to Newport and we get to Nantucket, and we've got two dogs, and you know, I think an equal life of what I would have had I had two legs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, yeah. And let me, you mentioned paying your bills and doing stuff like that. And, as somebody, like most people luckily never have to do it, but the importance of like the GoFundMe and all of that stuff, you were on the other side of that. What is that? What is it like seeing that, like the support that you get for stuff like that?
You know, DJ, that's a really good question. And that's not something that anybody has ever asked that. It's difficult. Mm. It's, you know, I'll never forget one of the first groups that were there to help us was the Greg Hill Foundation. So, you know, if you're from the Massachusetts area, Greg Hill was a DJ or is a DJ. Mm-hmm. He was on one radio station. Now he's on WEEI. Oh my God.
The dog's a big fan of Greg Hill. What can you say?
Exactly. So, you know, I remember someone saying Greg Hill is, you know, bringing you a check, you know, the Greg Hill Foundation. And all I could think of is why and how am I going to pay them back? Like, I don't want to check. Like, I'm going to have to pay these people back.
That's for sure.
Like, I didn't understand.
Right.
What was going on. And then the other part of it is, like, I've always been on the other side of it where, you know, I would volunteer and still do, but, mm-hmm. you know, volunteer for the Dana-Farber Foundation. So, you know, I'd do volunteer out there at the walk that they do, the scooper bowl with the ice cream and mm-hmm. Different things, the telethon they do. And, you know, I was the one that was able-bodied to help people that weren't. And now it's flipped and I'm the one that needs the help. And it's not easy to accept it. It's not easy to understand it. And, you know, it's challenging mentally, to be honest, in that aspect. But the other side of it, prosthesis and, you know, dealing with these things, it's expensive and insurance doesn't cover it, you know, or all of it or some of it sometimes. And it depends on, you know, what your insurance is, if you have insurance and, you know, whatever your level is. And I, again, you know, fortunate for when I became an amputee and how I became an amputee, because I've been able to get the best of the best because they gifted it to us at the time because of all media sensation. And at times I feel guilty about that. Like, you know, it's not something I asked for. It's not something that I fought for and, or whatever. It was just offered and not knowing any better, I accepted. And now it's a level I, you know, I'm at, and it's difficult because I feel bad for some people that either have a birth defect or have like a car accident or a work accident. And now they're an amputee and something they didn't ask for, but it's not a media sensational situation. And now they've got to figure out how do they get through life. And that's one thing that I really feel that it's important for me to pay it forward. And if I know someone who's becoming an amputee or has just became an amputee, my Spalding doctor recommends me speaking with people. And I have a couple of my PT therapists, my physical therapists, that they'll be like, hey, Roseanne, can you meet with this person? They just became amputated. And I feel like it's such an important part of what I went through that I need to pay it forward and hope mm-hmm. that can make it as easy for them as someone made it for me.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what you've been doing with your public speaking. You've been all over the place with that public speaking, helping other people, helping other amputees, and all of that. And do you want to get into the Heather Abbott Foundation, which is pretty much right up that, right?
Absolutely. And so, oddly enough, Heather and I were friends prior to the Boston Marathon bombing. I knew her from times of going down in Newport, and we've got mutual friends. She was actually not far behind me just going into Forum when that second bomb went off. And her leg was so damaged that she had to make the choice to be amputated. And what she ended up doing from that is she has now started the Heather Abbott Foundation, which I do as much supporting of her foundation as possible, because she's helping so many people get back to a life of, you know, activity with new prosthesis, whether it's an arm or feet or running blade or a knee. She has been able to help so many people. You know, for me, it's a little more difficult because I'm above knee, but there's a couple of people that I know that she has helped with being below knee, that she's gotten them dress up legs so that you cannot tell if they have a fake leg on or not because of a silicone cover, and insurance definitely does not cover anything like that.
No,
and
not aesthetics.
No. And it costs thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And, you know, this is just something to help someone feel good about themselves. Someone, you know, like, it's odd when you become deformed, you know, like it's just after living with something for so long and then now you don't have it anymore and you don't look like everybody else. And, you know, so I know, again, I'm good at rambling, DJ, I apologize, but
don't apologize at all.
The Heather Abbott Foundation has, you know, been something really good that's come out of it. And she's helping so many people. You know, she just gave away a couple of running blades right before the marathon to help people get back into being active. And again, I think being active helps mentally, physically, and, you know, health insurance really should consider supporting it a little bit more than they do, because then you wouldn't have so much obesity or
the mental health.
I mean, yeah. I used to run because it cleared my head, you know, and it's not easy to do, but, you know, hopefully, you know, there's bike legs out there for people that want to ride bikes. There's running blades for people who want to run, and you can't have all of them if you don't know where to look. And that's somewhere that I tried to help support Heather Abbott so that people can get back to the life that they want.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but being that Heather, you know, is a female, I just think with amputees, and I've been told it several times, that there's far fewer female amputees than males, because most of them happen because it's industrial accidents or motorcycle car accidents or something like that. So there's less female amputees. So having like a female advocate like Heather, and, you know, like, you know, she just, I mean, she helps men too, but having, you know, like a pretty woman that, you know, girls can see her and think, hey, I can be everything she is. And I think it's very powerful. I've heard, you know, some female amputees say that, and with Heather helping them, that she is very empowering. And it's different, I think, because there's a lot of veteran groups and guys, it's different. And, you know, to them, I don't know, I could be wrong, but I feel like to some veterans, it's like a badge of honor. And they're kind of like, they're proud of their leg looking so almost robotic, you know?
Yeah, there's a different mentality just between anything between a man and a woman. And it's like Roseanne and Heather being able to relate to them as a woman, right? As a guy, I'd be like, Roseanne told me a story of somebody that visited her once in those first few days, weeks, and you're like, athletes and stuff and people, but they're like, they don't know what to say,
right?
And it's like, And it's like, so now how does, even though if a guy's an amputee, you're talking to a woman and you're like, well, you know, when it happened to me, the first thing a woman's thinking is, well, you don't know what I'm thinking. You're like, and a lot of what you said tonight, Roseanne, was like, you know, you take pride in hiding that and making it like the taxi driver that's like, he didn't even know, you know? And it's like, where a guy is like, he's wearing long pants and he's pulling his leg up so people can see some carbon fiber and they get the looks and, you know, and like, and then you get to, instead of having Mike look at him, you get to look at him. Like, oh yeah, what do you see there? You know, it's like, I mean, it's a completely different mentality. So having you guys to be able to do this and, or what you're doing is fantastic. And then Heather also, it is a mental, you know, it's part of your mental health, and almost everything you've said, Roseanne, is about like, I just want to feel normal. And it's like, you're trying, like you said, you can't get up at night and just roll out of bed and go to the bathroom. And it's like, that's one simple thing. Never mind the rest of, oh, I want to go for a run or I want to go do this. It's like, most people think like, oh, I'm going to go running. Well, I'm going to go buy new sneakers. Right. And it's like, you've got to, you know, you poor people have to go through like a Heather Abbott Foundation if you want to go for a run.
Yeah. And right down to, you know, like the ankle or the foot, if you, like someone told me about an adjustable ankle, which, you know, is more expensive than a fixed ankle. But if you have the fixed ankle, then you can basically only wear one type of shoe because, you know, everybody's like every shoe is different with its soles and its thickness and its angles and all that. So it's difficult. Like there's just so many things that you don't think of on a normal basis if you have gone from being a two-legger to a one-legger. And there's just so many different things that kind of come into, I know, I'm sorry.
Go from a two.
You're a two-legger, he's a two-legger, I'm a one-legger. I know no-leggers. There's some no-leggers out there.
Jeez.
And you know, it's just everything, like you just don't, even if the ground is, I mean, we had gone for a walk and I stumbled because, you know, my foot doesn't adjust to the impact onto the ground, right? Like,
right.
It doesn't know to adjust when you have a regular leg, you've got muscles, you've got tendons, like you step down and your body just goes with the flow.
Right.
And if I hit it, it makes me stumble or whatever. And to be able to have different heels, to be able to adjust it, like the different planes, it just helps. And not everybody gets that opportunity. And if your insurance doesn't cover it, then there's going to be foundations out there. And one of the best ones is the Heather Abbott Foundation.
Nice. Yeah. And I saw her. A lot of her stuff earlier. You had mentioned it when we first talked. You were talking about Heather, and so yeah, that's what we will this month. We will be giving 100% of whatever comes into Brightside Home Theater from the listeners. So
thank you so much, DJ.
No problem.
All counts.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's the idea. So, but yeah, it's HeatherAbbottFoundation.org. So you can either donate to me, the various ways you can donate to the podcast with buying boxes of popcorn on the website or Patreon support, or you can just click on the link and go and give it directly to them. Doesn't matter. Either way, it's all going to them.
It's all appreciated. Yeah. Thank you.
So, guys, that's, I made it. I told, I told people in my podcast, I'm like, this is going to be a tough one. Cause like I said, Steve, my co-host, he was like, I think I told him a couple of years ago, he was on my show as a listener. And after we were done recording, he lives in England and he's big fan. Yeah. He's a big fan of Boston. He's been over here. He loves the cities. And so he actually asked me about the marathon bombing after we finished recording. He wanted a perspective of somebody that lives here. And I was like, oh boy. Let me tell you. So I told him the story and it was late at night and we had just probably recorded for like 2 hours and And he's like, that was a tough night for you. It's like, I have, you know, I had trouble getting through the story and stuff. So he's like, what are you going to do? I go, I don't know. I'm probably going to edit out a lot of stuff, a lot of like silent moments. But no, we did good. We did good. And
No, I mean, with it being 10 years out, I've had my moments of reflection and a lot of time with it. Like if it's a downtime, something really not going on, but also with all the public speaking and even just doing these podcasts or interviews, I think for me, it's helped me understand or accept it or something to be able to talk about it more and more. I don't think that I would be where I am today if I didn't have had, if I hadn't had the opportunity to speak with so many people about it. And I think that truly has helped a lot, a lot. So, you know, thank you for wanting to speak with us and giving us the opportunity to talk a little bit more about it. And every day is a step away from, it almost seems like it never happened, oddly enough, but.
That's good. And it's like, I get emotional because like Mike said earlier, this, you're helpless. What can I do? And it's listening to you, talking to you and your strength. You're just like, oh, okay, she's in a good mood. Let's go with that. Right. And it's like, but other than that, it's like when I tell people the story and I'm like, it's like you do, you feel helpless. How can we help? How can we do more? What can we do? And it's like I said, Mike does everything that day, gets you to the hospital, goes back and is thinking, now what else can I do? Because you're right. You do, Mike, like you said, you feel helpless, but you just want to do more. And it's, you know, people, and at the time it was just Roseanne, but many people were going through much worse. So how do you help them? So, but yeah, thanks, Roseanne.
Thank you, DJ. Thank you.
All right. No problem. We will, let's end on that. Mike, you got anything else you want to say? Cause this is the most I've heard you talk.
Yeah. We'll have to do that more often.
Yeah. We got to get I got to play Jenga.
I like it.
You and Jen come down. We'll get a Jenga game going.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Get Don and Justin. We'll play some Jenga and Mike can DJ the whole event.
Absolutely.
He should have been a DJ. He still should try to DJ because he's good with it. He's so quick with it. And everybody's like, how did you come up with that song? Or how did you get that? And, you know, I think some of it is to make you laugh and make you knock the thing over. So
absolutely it is.
But yeah. it's his strategic plan of getting you to lose and him to win.
Oh, Justin said it's insane. He's like, the music you come up with, how fast you come up with it. And it's like, he was just telling me about it and he was cracking up. So, and, Dawn can't wait to hear this. She's like, tell me what is coming out. Tell me what is coming out. So,
funny.
Yeah.
Well, so. Thank you. Hi, Dawn.
Yeah, there you go. So, all right. Thank you guys very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, DJ. Yeah, let Mike, us know when it drops.
We'll do. Mike and Roseanne, everybody. And we're giving to the Heather Abbott Foundation at heatherabbottfoundation.org. Thank you very much. Go push play. It's not over yet. So thank you to, again, first and foremost, thank you to Roseanne and Mike for coming on and telling their story. It's not easy to do, as you guys could tell. So, but thank you for listening. Thank you, the listener, for listening all the way through. And for listening all the way through, as I said earlier, it's a pretty big thank you right here. I reached out to SVS because I was so, you know, moved after talking to Roseanne and Mike, and also thinking about you guys, the listeners, for giving me the confidence to do this. So I wanted to say thank you. So I reached out to SVS and explained exactly that to them. And I said, what could I do? What can we do? Is there any kind of incentive or something? And I had no idea what to do. And, you know, SVS has offered up a pair of Prime Wireless Pro powered speakers. And these are like $900, HDMI connection on the back. They just came out with these within the year. And they're like, yeah, why don't you, raffle these off to whoever donates? So that's what I'm going to do. So thank you for listening. So all you have to do, you don't even have to donate. All you have to do is have listened to the podcast. To show me that you listen to the podcast, just email me, dj@brightsidehometheater.com. In the subject line, all you got to write is Row Strong. If you go to her website, that's her logo and Row Strong. And so if the subject line says Row Strong, you get an entry into the Prime Wireless Pro powered speakers. If you donate directly to the Heather Abbott Foundation, and the link for that is in the show notes. So if you donate to that, you get 5 entries, regardless of the amount. What you have to do there is you donate directly to Heather Abbott, just screen grab it, whatever, the receipt of your donation, and email me that, and that'll get you 5 entries. Just for listening, you get 1. Donate any amount directly to Heather Abbott, you get 5 entries. Thank you to SVS. I'm tiny little podcast here, but if we can raise some money for, you know, the Heather Abbott Foundation, which means a lot to Roseanne, obviously, I'd really appreciate that. So, and yeah, these things are crazy. I have the SVS Pro sound base and I use Aura speakers. These things are pretty cool, and you can connect them to your TV, which is, I think they added that from the older version where you can, so you can connect them to your TV with an HDMI. So pretty cool. But yeah, you can go to SVS and see more about them at SVS. That link's in the show notes as well. I'll make sure to put it there. So yeah, and this is going to run for 2 weeks. I will draw the listener live on our live stream on Tuesday, May 9th. We start streaming around 4 p.m. So, but I'll also email you if you don't happen to hear that, if you're the winner. So yeah, on Tuesday, May 9th, 4 p.m., our live stream, I will be drawing the winner of these. So again, just email me, you know, Row Strong in the subject line. Email me at dj@brightsidehometheater.com or email me the receipt for 5 entries into the raffle for the SVS Prime Wireless Pro powered speakers. So again, thank you very much. Thank you to Roseanne and Mike. Thank you so much. Hopefully we do some real good here for Heather Abbott Foundation. So, all right, that's the end of the podcast. Now you can go push play. Thank you very much.
Hey, Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.